Saturday, May 7th from 8 to 1 at the Kenosha County Building in Bristol. For more information regarding what is disposable, visit kenoshacounty.org or dial 857-1935.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Brown, your host for Education Matters today, and we'll have two segments on today's program. My first guest will be Dr. Jim Goniger, and he is the superintendent of schools in the Lake Geneva School District. And then I'll be joined by T.J. Morris, who is the author of Blood is Thicker Than Color.
And I'm actually sitting in the administrative offices of the superintendent of Lake Geneva School Districts, Dr. Jim Goniger, and it's a pleasure to have you here on Education Matters.
Well, thanks for the invitation, and I look forward to the conversation, and hopefully we both gain some insights from our conversation today.
Give us a quick overview of the Lake Geneva School District as far as the schools that encompass the district and just your overall snapshot, if you will.
Okay. Well, it is a unique area. You know, the southeastern Wisconsin has kind of a monopoly on the Union High School districts in the state of Wisconsin. I think, to be pretty unique in the state of Wisconsin, maybe in the country, in the fact that I'm the superintendent for two school districts. So my immediate responsibilities are to run the Lake Geneva Joint Number 1 School District, which is an elementary district, 4K through 8, that has its own school board, and then the Lake Geneva Genoa City Union High School District, which has its own school board as the high school district. All of the kids from the 4K through 8 district do go to our high school. But then we also have three outlying districts that we have good relationships with. We do a lot of curriculum work with, but I'm not the superintendent for. And so presents some interesting challenges. Genoa City has its own 4K through 8th grade school district, as does Lynn J6, I believe is that number, also known as Traver School, and the Wood School District, which is Geneva J4. So with that, you know, I am responsible for the education of about 3,500 students, and we bring in from those other school districts probably another 500 or so students in a particular, particular time period. And then we do have some parochials also that we help with and bring into our high school district when they leave those schools. So that's kind of it for Lake Geneva. Walworth County, Elkhorn's in Lake Geneva, in the Walworth County area too. Not like us, but as you head toward Kenosha County, as you said, you get that with Waterford and Westosha. Wilmot school districts are kind of like mine, even though they only have one superintendent for the high school, and then they usually have a different administration for the elementary districts.
I was looking at what you have as the board goals for both the Joint Number 1 district and also the Badger high school district, if you will. And there's a lot of overlap, obviously, looking at developing a strategic plan. Maybe if you could give a bit of an overview about how the planning is going as far as looking into the future.
Strategic planning is very exciting for me and I think for our community and our schools because it isn't my agenda and it isn't their agenda. We are looking for input from our communities. We have done surveys of our parents. We'll be bringing that data to the strategic planning event, which is going to take place in April. We have the 7th and 8th of April and the 14th of April. An offsite, we'll have about 50 people that are going to be involved in this. That'll include students, probably from the high school mostly, parents, staff, professional staff, support staff, board, and then administration. So, you know, I think it's the direction is to find out what our people are perceiving the needs to be and forging a mission from that. We've been involved with this. It actually is our policy on how to bring about school improvement is to use the strategic planning process. This will be about our fourth plan, I believe, maybe our fifth since I've been here. With that, we retired one a little bit over a year ago, and so it's kind of fresh eyes with fresh people on you know what direction we do need to take. You know, these tend to look at things like facilities and instruction and you know, teacher professionalism and those types of things. But that's not to say, you know, we're going to have a facilitator, Joe Schrader, who's with the Association of Wisconsin School Administrators, is going to facilitate this event for us. And whatever the people come out with, we'll take that to the boards to see if they will buy into this as the direction for our school districts, and we'll follow it. That really is it. And I think the exciting part is, and sometimes you get this when you're a superintendent or a principal, that, you know, they, meaning the administration, is telling us what we have to do, and they don't have a clue, you know, that's this comes from them. And, you know, you usually do get around as educators that there's a lot of like minds out there, and parents bring a great perspective to this, too. Most of the parents that are going to be involved in this have been members of our various school councils or PTOs, but they, again, are invested in the schools and the education of their children. So pretty exciting time. It's something that I think superintendent, any administrative a person in the schools really looks forward to as an exciting, energizing experience, and I assume that this will be that for us again.
I mean, as you know, there's always a discussion and concerns among many with regards to testing, with people saying that we do too much testing, and even questions like, okay, with all the testing we do, what do we actually do with the results of those all the testing? Maybe if you could talk a bit about the testing program that will be taking place in both the Joint Number 1 District and at Badger High School, and just your perspective of your many years in education in terms of how you really use those test results on the ground, if you will, to ultimately help the teachers do a better job in teaching all the students in the district?
Well, I probably would be among that choir that thinks we probably have too much testing. So it is it's a dilemma. You know, we have to test. We are mandated to test. We will continue to follow those mandates. And so with that, you know, your question is a good one. What do we do with those results? When you have a test that's given for 1 year and you change that test, we're not doing much with those results. You know, so, you know, I think our better testing is our internal testing that we do. We do use a MAP testing in our school district. And I think we do a darn good job, especially at the younger age levels, of looking at that data and restructuring our instruction on kids' needs. So that testing has been relatively good and not perfect because no testing is. And I do get concerned with the number of hours that we test kids that we aren't instructing kids because I don't think that the test does that. And so, yeah, you know, the important part of it is what are we really getting out of this test? And if we can have the time, and it takes time, and teachers then have to take that all of that data and change instruction for X number of kids in this area who may be struggling and kids who aren't struggling and need to be enriched, and then how we go about servicing those kids, it's a real challenge, you know, and I think it's a good thing to do. I mean, nobody could argue with philosophically with you know, individualizing instruction for children. However, on a practical basis, it's very difficult to do, and I think it has overwhelmed many of our staff members that when you have to get that balance of teachers' energy and passion to do the job that they want to do with kids versus analyzing test data, which honestly, I don't really think too many people went into education to do that. They went in to have a positive effect on kids. Now, that's learning, but it's also the relationship piece, which sometimes if we get too far on the other side of the testing issue, we can lose. And I think that'd be unfortunate, and I know our teachers feel that way.
Along those same lines, with any of the testing that you do, whether it be any of the internal testing at the grade levels or in any of the particular academic areas or even the statewide testing, how does that then translate into any changes that take place in the curriculum and the direction that you take at all the grade levels in terms of those goals that are placed on the programmatic areas?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we do work. I have a director of instruction who works very diligently with that whole process. And right, when we find gaps that are there, we try to address it with, filling the holes of those gaps in our curriculum. And you know, obviously, everybody's looking at math and at reading scores. Those are the two main test areas. But you know, we look at other areas too. Where can we help out with some of the other academic areas to improve reading or math? But I really think that the testing information shows if we don't have algebraic equations or we're short on multiplication, whatever the case might be, that then we as staff and with the leadership of the director of instruction find a answer or what we think is an answer to fill in those gaps.
I'm changing the subject from strictly academics. Certainly the high school, Badger High School, has an extraordinary extracurricular program and historically just outstanding programs, both athletic programs, your fine arts programs, your music programs. I've been at concerts and with the mm-hmm. band, the orchestra, the choral programs. I've been to the football games. How important is that aspect of the high school life for a student today and for the community?
Okay. Well, yeah, we're in for the whole thing, you know. So the whole student, you know, I think we have in our mission statement, I know we have in our mission statement, honoring the unique talents of all. So, you know, that goes into those things. We do, I think, as good a job or better than a lot of areas in terms of encouraging our kids to be part of many, many opportunities. Our coaches are good about trying not to dominate a student and direct a student into one sport activity, to send a message that, you know, play all three seasons. If the band is involved, I have a son over there right now, he plays on a basketball team and he plays in the pep band, you know, and they work out without, you know, being penalized that he can't make one because he's in the other. So I think there's a big cooperation with that. And, yeah, we have, I think the unique part of it is we very seldom say no to activities. A student not too long ago came up with the idea that she would like to have a debate club. And we have kind of the philosophy that if you can find somebody to advise it, we'll do it. You know, we'll give it a shot. So we don't pay people to do that, but people have been willing to step forward and, you know, monitor, to coach, to be involved with those types of things. And many times they have led then, you know, it's worked out and we have added it to our extracurricular, you know, venue of opportunities, because many, many students want to do it. So as far as I think the community feels that way too, we do attract open enrollment kids. We do have more students coming to our school district than leaving the high school district and the elementary for that matter. But it's, you know, and that's one of the reasons why people do come here, is that they like the opportunities that are here for our kids. And we have great facilities to have great venues for those programs that we do have. Everybody doesn't come up to me and say, you know, thanks for having this or thanks for having that, but I think that's the feeling here. They're appreciative. We have alumni that come back to our schools. We have several events. They're very much impressed with the changes that have taken place over the years on the physical plant as well as the opportunities that they see kids have in academic areas. But when they walk through our culinary area or our ag area or our technical education area or art, they're fantastic facilities that support those programs. And most of the people in our community, I think, are very appreciative of that.
I'll have a few questions that I'll kind of put into the category of a lightning round and just some fast question and a relatively fast answer. The first one, how do things stand economically and financially with the district? Obviously, the state level, a lot of budget cuts is always a difficulty if a district wants to pass a referendum and everyone's concerned about taxes. So how do both districts, both the high school district and the joint number one district, look financially at this point in time?
You know, we are on solid ground with an asterisk, you know, behind it, because the last few years have been tough financially. There's always been a revenue limit, not always, but for many, many years now, the revenue limits. So we've lived within that revenue limit. I think it's been tough in terms of the teacher compensation issue. And, we know this year the CPI is 0.012. In our case, that's $48. So it's hard to, from that standpoint, can you function on a $48? Well, of course you can. Is that what you really want to do? That's another story. Again, I have help here. I have a tremendous business manager. We look at every single opportunity it is that we can save money in various areas to compensate staff, to have programs, to do what we need to do. We're on solid ground with the asterisk. We sometimes need to switch our insurance carrier, to save money so it can be used somewhere else, to look at ways to, buy energy on the futures market, to work on our bus contracts, to make them more attractive. So every single pocket has to be examined in this day and age because you have to be very, very creative to keep it financially stable. With that, I think we've always had feeling here that as all of these cuts were taking place in education and to school districts, that we always wanted to be the last man standing, so to speak. And I think we're in good shape to be that. We're solid. And with that, we have another year in this particular state budget. And then, big question mark comes up again in the next one. So from an education perspective, they haven't been very friendly in the last few state budgets, and we'll have to see what happens in the next one.
You kind of led me into the second question with regards to Act 10. We're in the fifth year, almost the fifth year now, and obviously you touched upon some of the biggest concerns, and that is the issue of salaries, and there are a lot of districts that are losing classroom teachers who are going to other states, whether they're going to Illinois or Iowa or Minnesota. What impact overall has Act 10 had on the district?
Overall, it's a negative impact. It's a negative impact in terms of morale of staff and I think attraction to the profession in the state of Wisconsin. It's a different market, and our teachers haven't quite adapted to that yet. It is a market where, and we've had that happen here, where a teacher can go to another school district and kind of bargain their own contract. And, but it isn't the norm, and so they're not used to that. And since that operates as a business model, it's kind of a supply and demand type of thing. So if you're a chemistry teacher, you maybe have a relatively big bargaining chip, and if you're a third grade teacher, you might not. And that's not to to say that they don't do equally important job. It's just a matter of that's the business model, and you know, teachers aren't used to that. But you know, when you go and say that we're going to negotiate over $48, I mean, that you know, doesn't bode well for the profession going down the line either. You know, I don't know about attracting teachers to the profession if this is the mode as we go forward. I think that is a big question that we all have. You know, we have a goal that maybe you looked at on trying to look at compensation model. We are, and I think we're going to have something in place that's going to be very attractive, that's going to be able to retain our staff and treat them as professionals as we go forward. Not in place yet, but we're very close to doing that. But it's been a difficult time, you know, no doubt about that. And not saying some of those things that are there may not be good and the right thing to do. However, the change process has been difficult for people.
And my last question for you, because we have a lot of people who are listening who live in Kenosha and Racine counties and probably don't know that much about your school district, whether it's the Joint Number 1 district or the high school district, Badger High School. But if people are thinking about the possibility of looking at some other school district or districts for their children, I'll give you a chance to make a pitch for your school districts in terms of all the great things going on here.
Well, I'm kind of glad you asked that question too. So, one, you know, I've always sit down with candidates who are, want a teacher or interviewing for jobs here, and you know, so a lot of people say Lake Geneva, and they think that the streets are lined with gold, you know. So that's not true. So I want people to make sure they do understand that it's, you know, relatively normal Wisconsin community of about 7,000 people. So relatively, you know, like any other community is normal, but we have great schools, you know, so we try to keep our class sizes very low at the elementary level. We are involved with the SAGE program. We have been from almost the beginning and inception of SAGE. We take care of our facilities. We provide great facilities. I think our staff is very, very, I know our staff is very, very hardworking. I have four kids involved in these schools right now, and you know, they're all getting a solid education. The high school, once you get to the high school, if you can't find it at Badger, you can't find it. You know, we have tremendous programs. We have over 50 courses that are either AP or are articulated with the technical school. We have 20 of those courses are AP courses. That's a lot of the reason why people do come here. It's the variety of academic choices that they get to make. So we have the extracurricular events, and I think we have some fine coaches that are involved with those that have great relationships with kids that last a lifetime. So great place to be. There is a nice lake here. There's no gold on the streets. We're having a hard time with the ice sculptures this year, but would be a wise choice for people to choose the Lake Geneva schools, and with that, many of them do.
Well, I want to thank you for taking your time, and I'm very familiar with the school districts here, and it's been a pleasure, and I'm hopeful I can have you on in the future as a guest, and maybe have a teacher or two and one of your school administrators to talk more about your district.
That'd be great. So I appreciate the interview time, and glad we could make this work.
And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTD HD. And I'm very pleased to have in our studio TJ Morris, who's an author, a poet. She has a wonderful new book out called Blood is Thicker Than Color. TJ Morris, welcome to Education Matters.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Really appreciate it.
You know, you and I have worked together for a number of years because you're a member of the Kenosha Writers Guild, and when we had WGTD HD3, the Writers Guild was on once a month and everything, so we had a chance to interact, and I had a chance to hear bits and pieces of what is Blood is Thicker Than Color. So I had I had the opportunity to be exposed to it. But before we talk about your book, first of all, who is TJ Morris?
Who is T.J. Morris? That's a very good question. I think you probably already told everybody, but I'm a poet and just an everyday person, everyday lady. I like to be myself. I'm not very formal, very informal, but I also like to express myself through art. I believe in trying to help the community and trying to help educate, especially our youth today, as far as their whole history, especially Black history, as far as that goes. The youth, sometimes they seem to be a little lost, you know. It's like I've been doing this presentation during Black History Month this month, and I've been at several of the libraries. And I have a question that I ask, and I've been getting some pretty good responses. And the question is, if you could give the youth something, what do you want them to have? And I don't mean material. You know, so people have been, they've been writing down their answers and leaving those for me. And they've been real interesting to see what people want to give to the youth. So some kind of way through this book, through me going around and doing my presentation about genealogy and the book and all of that, I am trying to get more to the youth. And the good thing is that some of the youth are starting to read it. Their parents are buying the book, and their kids are taking it, you know. So that's good. And my target group is 10th graders and up. So that's kind of who I am and what I do and spend all my time doing. And I love to do my art and my craft and enjoy doing it.
I know in your book, and I know you've talked about it, and you and I have talked about it before, that you actually didn't start writing formally, if you will, in terms of as an author until about 2004, when you wrote your first book of poetry called The True Heart.
This is correct.
Maybe take us back to 2004 just for a moment or two. What motivated you at that time to write your book of poetry called The True Heart?
It's kind of funny. I really had never considered myself a poet. I had never written a poem before and didn't really set out to write a poem. I called myself starting off, I was going to write a short story, right? And I wrote the short story, but it was a story in poem form. So it was full of phrases, and, you know, when I got through writing it, I said, well, you know, these aren't complete sentences or anything. And, you know, I'm reading the poem, and I shared it with some people, and I was like, okay. And they were like, oh, that's a poem, you know. So it just kind of evolved from there. It was like the next thing I knew, I said, well, okay, well, I wrote a poem. Let me see, can I write another one? And then I just started kind of telling this story. Because I had, I guess my life was starting to calm down now. It had been pretty difficult up to that point. There was one point in my life when I was homeless for a little bit, and my daughter and I, and I had a lot to say, you know. So and that's kind of how the poetry book goes. It kind of goes up and down, and it tells a story, and I encourage people that, you know, who had an opportunity to read it from beginning to end, because it told a story in poetry form. And I'll be putting out another poetry book soon. It'll be coming out in the spring, because that book was called The True Heart, and it's no longer on the market anymore. But I've taken a lot of poems from that book, along with some newer poems, and I'm putting them all into a new book. So.
Let's talk now about your book, Blood is Thicker Than Color. First of all, what is the significance of the title?
The significance of the title. I think to me, it's kind of self-explanatory, and I don't want to just give the book away, but my grandfather was a very, very light Negro, okay? And like I say, he did he got himself in trouble. He ended up running up to Chicago from Mississippi.
And the time period?
And the time period was the 1920s. And anyway, he had to change his name. He had to hide out, and he had to do all these things. But he was also related to a ex-governor of Mississippi, who was Earl Leroy Brewer. And for me, that's how the title kind of ties in, you know, to the blood is thicker than color, how his uncle did come along and, you know, eventually help him. And it didn't matter that the ex-governor was white and that my grandfather was a color. It had no bearing on it, mm-hmm. you know, because blood was thicker than color.
Give us a sense, if you would maybe give us a quick synopsis of the overall study. You've already alluded, I'll start that question again, because I can edit that out. Give us a quick synopsis of the story without giving away all the juicy details. You've already alluded to the time period and the relationship that goes back to a white man who was governor of the state of Mississippi. But give us just an overall encapsulation of the book and the story.
Well, like you said, Pamela already said a lot of it. My grandfather got into an incident with a white sheriff in down in Mississippi. And he, in the process, there was a woman that got killed. Now, so my grandfather had to leave because even though, you know, he wasn't responsible for this woman being killed, he had to get out of there because he knew that he was going to get the consequences for it, that they were going to string him up for doing that. So he ran and was able to get up north. And he hid out. Like I say, he had to change his name and all of that. And he got to do some pretty interesting things, which is where a lot of the history that's in the book comes in. Because, unfortunately, my grandfather's been dead a long time. And I didn't get to actually interview him for this book and ask him what he did those 2 years. But I did get a chance to take those points as I was stringing part A to B to C and fill it in with some real Chicago history. So there you get to, I get to talk about Oscar Micheaux, and I talk about Alberta Hunter, and I talk about Sammy Stewart. I talk about White City Amusement Park, which was a real place that a lot of people don't know about, maybe not even heard of before. But if you know anything about White City murders, the mm-hmm. murders from, you know, homes back in that day, the amusement park was like after that time. But still, you know, they all kind of connect during that period. So there's a lot of history that's in the story, and I get to be able to fill it in with a lot of that. Jack gets to be around. Jack is my grandfather, and he's the main character. And he's around. He gets to be with some of his family. There's a lot of real characters, real people in this story. You can see those characters. You can find out a little bit more about them. They're all on my website. That's tjmorris.info. And I have photos of those people. And you get to see more about exactly what they look like and a little bit more about their life. There are some fictional people in there too, but there's a lot of real people in this book also.
You talked about the fact that all the research you did, you also went down to Mississippi and you did research. And maybe if you could talk a bit about that and going into the cage, if you will, and actually looking at real information, you know, it was like an archival cage. What was that experience like?
It was a real interesting experience taking the trip to Mississippi. Actually, a girlfriend and I went. And we went to Clarksdale, and we went to Jackson. And I went to Clarksdale because at the time I was actually still trying to figure out what the governor's connection was to my family.
And this is Governor Brewer.
This is Governor Brewer, yes. Because at the time, I didn't know. My dad had left me some information, and Dad just knew he was kinfolk. So I needed to find out how he was kinfolk. How was he related to us? So the governor had spent a lot of time in Clarksdale, and especially his later years. So I went there, went to the library in Clarksdale, And I wanted to look up some microfilm. I figured I'd start looking at some newspapers or something, see what information I could find. So the librarian, she asked me, she says, well, what name are you looking for? So I said, Brewer. I knew before that came out of my mouth, she was going to say, oh, it's a whole lot of brewers, because it was. It was a lot of brewers in that part of Mississippi. So she says, are you looking for Earl Leroy Brewer? I said, yes, I'm looking for him. I didn't tell her he was related to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell her any of that. She said, oh, yeah. She says, sure, we have some information on him. She said, now, we have this cage over here. It was a cage in the library, and where they kept special information, special
documents. And this is a cage. This is a cage that's locked and,
yeah.
I mean, a real secure place, right?
It's a cage. Yeah, it's locked. It's like a room off to itself, and they called it the cage. And you couldn't take your purse in. Like, if you were a lady, you had to take your purse and lock it in a locker. So my girlfriend and I, we put our purses in the locker and everything, went into the cage. And the librarian, she got the information that they had on Earl Leroy Brewer. And there were family tree information that was in there, and it was a biography that his daughter had written about her father's life. There was, I think, a letter from his wife or something. There were newspaper articles. So there was several, there was a lot of information on him there. But it was kind of funny to me because we were in this cage, and you could copy anything you wanted. She was like, oh, you can copy whatever you want. But the copy machine was out in the other area of the library. I thought that was so funny. So anyway, I was pulling material out and giving it to my girlfriend, and she was going and copying it. But all in all, it was good. I was able to get some good information. And I was still also looking for my great-grandfather, John Allen Brewer. I was looking for his connection. You know, I figured to find the governor's connection, I needed to find him too, as far as the relationship between our family. And it was a lot of Johns in their information. It was so many Johns, a lot of Johns in my family. So I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking through all this different family tree information, and which gave me a lot of information on Earl Leroy. But then I came to realize that I wasn't going to find my grandfather. I said, you're not going to find grandfather here, because my great-grandfather, John Allen, his mother was a slave. So I was like, you're not going to find them in these records. You know, so I was like, okay. So then I realized, okay, well, if I can just figure out, I could find William Fletcher Brewer, who was the slave owner, okay, who was also my great-great-grandfather. So I was like, okay, if I can find William Fletcher, then I can find out how the governor relates to William Fletcher, and then I can work it out from there. So that's what I was able to do, which I was able to find out that William Fletcher, and he had a brother. His brother's name was Leroy, which is who the grandson, the governor, was also named after, were brothers. And they're... So I was able to figure out what the connection was.
In the few minutes we have left, and I had asked you ahead of time if you might read just a passage or two from the book. And again, you know, not giving away anything overly magical that would give the whole story away, but something that that really touches you, that that I know will touch our listeners as well.
Would the author's note be okay?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to read the author's note then. I have a story to tell. Earl Leroy Brewer was the 38th governor of Mississippi. He was also my grandfather's second cousin. This made him my second cousin, twice removed on my dad's side of the family. My grandfather's grandpa and the ex-governor's grandpa were brothers. For most of my life, I thought these men were Irish, but after my own DNA test and genealogy search, I learned that they were not. I also learned that I am 27.69% European and 72.31% West African. My grandpa's name was Eugene Jack Brewer. His grandfather was William Fletcher Brewer. Around 1848, William went to Tennessee to buy a 16-year-old mulatto, domestic slave girl named Jane. Jane was described as having long, beautiful hair, long enough for her to sit on as he rode on a horse that trailed behind William on their journey back to Mississippi. William depended on Jane to cook, clean, and nurse him back to health when he became sick. During that time, he would cry out, "It's all hell in my throat." As it turned out, she wasn't just a domestic servant and nurse. Jane was his mistress, with whom he fathered five children. Jane and their children lived in a home on William's land. My great-grandpa, John Allen Brewer, was one of these children, and Eugene Jack Brewer's father. After William died in 1874, the authorities came to the house and forced Jane to open a strong box where people usually housed their important papers and valuables, such as bonds, gold, deeds to land and promissory notes, etc., for safekeeping. The authorities stole everything that was in the strong box, leaving Jane and her children with little or nothing. Shortly after, Jane married a Negro man named Mr. Cox. Governor Brewer was born in 1868, and my great-grandfather was born 4 years earlier. My grandfather was born in 1905, all in Carroll County, Mississippi. A relationship did exist between great-grandpa John Allen Brewer and the ex-governor Earl Leroy Brewer, but one that did not permit play or even acknowledgement of family ties. This relationship of separation may have become a major contributing factor to the wonderful compassion that ex-governor Earl Leroy showed for people of color. This is the story I have to tell, a family story about my grandfather and what his cousin, the former governor of Mississippi, Earl Leroy Brewer, did for him in the 1920s. This is a story of struggles and acceptance and survival.
T.J. Morris, let me ask you one more question, and that is, I know you're planning to do a reading, and I'll call it a stage performance reading, I believe on the 25th. And where is that going to be held?
That's going to be at this place called Fusion, and it's in Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's down on 7th Avenue. It's around 7th and 52nd Street in that area. And it's at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. And everyone is welcome. And the place is kind of small. It's a performing arts place, but it's really a nice place. And I'll be performing that day. There's about 8 or 9 other storytellers. We'll all be telling stories.
And without giving anything away, it will have a bit without giving anything away, it will have a few surprises, I believe, right?
Yes, it will have a few surprises. And let's just say I've been kind of working on my Southern talk a little bit, so it's starting to become part of my brain.
Well, I grew up in the South, so I have to, you know, I can spend 4 or 5 days down in Florida or Mississippi or Alabama, and all of a sudden my Southern accent starts to come back because that's where I grew up. You mentioned your website, tjmorris.info.
That's great.
Your book, Blood is Thicker Than Color. How can people buy your book?
They can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. They can go to the website. It's linked. It'll link you, take you right on to Amazon. They can purchase the book there. It comes in paperback, and it also comes in Kindle.
And I'm going to ask you, after we stop this recording, if you would sign my book that I purchased. You didn't. I did not ask for a free copy. I bought a book, and because I believe in supporting our authors. T.J. Morris, thank you so much for being my guest here on Education Matters. Give me a one-sentence description of this book.
Oh, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show today.
Sure.
It is a wonderful, great Black history read. It's a book about Black history, Black education. It's a book that talks about a lot of things and places that are just gone in our past, but it's still history, and we need to know what it is. So it's for 10th graders and up, so there's nothing in this book that those high schoolers can read and learn about. So.
I would agree 100%. I'm Steve Brown, thanking you for listening to Education Matters this morning. My guests were Dr. Jim Goniger, who is the superintendent of schools in the Lake Geneva School District,
and also T.J. Morris, author of the book Blood is Thicker Than Color. Next month, my guest will be Robin Voss, who's the Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly, and we'll be talking about all kinds of educational issues and some of the legislation that is pending and what the future holds for education